Good evening and happy Shabbat. Also, happy Pesach for those that are celebrating it on the Hebrew calendar method, as opposed to those of us who chose to celebrate it with the reckoning from the new moon closest to the vernal equinox and have done so already. Good evening to you, Larry. How are you?
Good. Having a good Pesach. You know, it's all good. Bought some really good matzah, by the way. Instead of Manischewitz, I got this. It's called Yehuda. And funny, oddly, they get rid of the Yah. They make it Yehuda.
Yeah, I've had Yehuda. I've had Manischewitz. And I don't know if you have Trader Joe's around there, but my favorite is actually Trader Joe's has some that's really kind of crispy burnt on the outside. It has a kind of an interesting flavor. They've toasted it a little more. I happen to be a fan of matzah, and since I didn't read anywhere that says that, that you couldn't eat matzah past the seventh day, I keep
eating it all the time.
My favorite snack. favorite snacks.
Yeah, I like it when I start eating it and then forget how much I like it and it kind of goes away. But, the Yehuda, I really like.
Thing that I don't do regularly, but I really, really like during Pesach and matzah is dipping it in the olive oil with the bitter herbs. The combination of matzah, olive oil, and bitter herbs is that's good food. As far as I'd rather have that than chips and guacamole.
So, no, I hear you. No, that's what I had last night with my lamb, and it was absolutely excellent. I sent Yalda out to get wine because I was very busy. Typically, I go out and buy it. Typically, I buy something not, you know, outrageous, but usually about $100 a bottle. Well, she went to Publix and started talking to the manager and came in, and she said she got this stuff for $28 a bottle. And this stuff was so good. It was way better than what I've been spending. And then she goes, well, I got to be honest with you. It was $9.99. That's the only one he knew that was really good. And I drank $10 wine last night, and it was excellent.
You know, my whole view on red wines in particular, I don't typically have the same view on white wines, but on red wines in particular, that there's never any reason to spend more than between $10 and $15.
Well, I think that's true with red wine.
Really outstanding red wine between $10 and $15.
Well, she got it for $9.99, which I never would have done because I would have assumed it was rot gut, you know, but I would have been wrong.
Speaking of rot gut, so, do you know what the great conspiracy is now in, as it relates to the ingredients for the Pesach meal?
No. What? What is it now?
Extra virgin olive oil. 80% extra virgin olive oil sold in America is not actually olive oil. It's mineral oil with coloring and flavoring, and it's marketed by the mafia.
Yeah, I know. And I asked Yalda, "Is this real?" Because she had extra virgin that she'd bought. She smelled it and she said, "No." And believe me, she knows her herbs. She knows. She's from the Mideast. She said, no, this is not real. No.
Yeah.
It just makes me angry, really.
They've the mafia has an 80% share now of olive oil and have replaced it with mineral oil with a little coloring and flavoring. And so you really have to be on your guard when buying it to make sure that you're not buying mineral oil.
Well, we got robbed, and this was an Italian brand, so, we got robbed.
Yeah, that's where the mafia headquarters out, so it's, you know, they're
sure. Corrado Brecca is actually their headquarters over there, believe it or not.
Italian brands. So how are you, Kirk?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you.
Yeah. Good. So we.
I drink $10 bottles of wine or less, and it's okay.
Yeah, I do.
I had a neighbor who used to live across the street named Robert Balsers, and he was 40 years the wine critic for the L.A. Times and a very famous guy in the wine business. And he was in his 80s at that point. And
he said go for the 10 bucks.
Well, no, we would go up to his house and you'd have a $1,000 bottle of champagne. And because everybody's brother in the world, we'd send him stuff, so he'd do it on his radio show or on his newspaper. Uh-huh. And he'd come to my house and drink $6 bottles of wine. And you know, I asked him one time, I said, well, what's the secret? He says, if it tastes good, you drink it.
Yeah. You know, back in the day that I was running and owning large businesses, most of the time when somebody was trying to sell us something, it came into town, they would bring you know, $500 bottle of champagne. I mean, it was, and I had Dom Perignon, the best vintages, stuffed in cupboards and drawers, because I very seldom drank it, and it just piled up. Since that time, I've found that you don't have to spend a lot of money to have something that tastes good.
A lot of good wines.
Yeah, a good, particularly in the case of a good wine. You know, one of the things about Passover that troubled me a great deal when I was thought about the Christian approach, which is to although they don't understand it, they observe what they call Good Friday. They don't recognize that Good Friday is Passover, and they have no idea that the sacrificial lamb of God was in fact the Passover lamb, and they have no understanding the correlation between Passover and life. But the worst thing that Satan could possibly do to someone is to get them to celebrate Passover and not Matzah. And so is my, you know, it would be eternal damnation. But, you know, one of the things that struck me as I was celebrating Passover most recently with my son is that God made sure that there's no chance of that. That if you were to pass away during Passover, having celebrated Passover, but not having celebrated Matzah, you would not actually be condemned to eternal damnation. You know why that is?
Why?
What did you eat with your Passover lamb?
Well, matzah, bitter herbs.
What is matzah?
Unleavened bread.
Right.
Oh,
and
okay.
What is the unleavened bread?
That's his matzah, yeah. You've actually celebrated the two into one.
That is correct. Matzah is integrated into Passover. Our Passover is integrated into matzah.
Well, so, it's almost a word picture. It's a word picture,
right,
when you look at how you're doing it. It's a word picture. I get it.
Yeah, you're doing both at the same time. It's one of the reasons why, and I know that there are many listeners to our program tonight who have a different view on this, and I don't challenge those who do. But my view is that the 7 days of matzah include Passover, where you
I used to think the opposite, but it says for 7 days you will not. And,
right.
And
right.
One of these days is today, which is Peacock, and so
right.
That's it.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
Right. And so I've come to realize that God is an extraordinarily thoughtful planner, and He designed Peacock in such a way that we get the benefits of eternal life and of perfection simultaneously, so that should someone pass away after Passover before Matzah, they still receive the integrated benefits of the two. And anyone who is deemed to be perfect and immortal is automatically adopted into God's family. So it's a comprehensive solution where the benefits start right from the beginning.
Why is it that the Jewish community, the Yehudim, why is it that they recognize Passover so much and they miss on Matzah and the Kippur?
Yeah, you almost never hear Matzah spoken of in the rabbinic community. And one of the things, too...
But they do it. They do Matzah.
But what they do is Matzah, if you say Matzah, that's associated with being Jewish. Like if you go to a grocery store, my son in Texas, when I went out and shopped for him, he only has one grocery store within 50 miles of his condo, and it of all names is Heap. So you're trying to
so
pick
it's
up
like a slide on Heap.
If you're going to a store called Heap, you know, only in Baptist Christian Texas could you have a store called Heeb. But when I went there, the first Mega Heeb, they had no matzah. And so, you know, I asked them, you know, where's your matzah? And the store manager's response is, we don't carry any of that Jewish stuff here. So there is an association with matzah and Jews. Yeah, I didn't even waste my time to explain to him.
That's like calling that's like calling Yahweh's Torah
the
Jewish Torah.
If you look around called the Bible, you would find that there's one Torah for everyone and one Pesach and matzah for everyone, and it is the only path to a relationship with God and to life. But I didn't bother to waste my time. I was talking with a Baptist.
I think you would have pretty much been wasting your time, that's for sure.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, there's some times where you just shake your head and say, you know, with this individual, there is no chance of benefit. Now, when I picked up the lamb, I had an hour conversation with the barkeep and assistant manager of a Longhorn Steakhouse about why I was picking up lamb and why it had to be prepared in a certain way. We didn't have a barbecue in my son's condo, so this was the best way to get it. And he was all ears, you know, so sometimes it's worth the investment of time and other times it's not. What I would say is that the Jews recognize that they should eat matzah, but they associate matzah with Passover, not with the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So
really?
There is a very weak assimilation of what matzah represents. And even if you look at Pesach and matzah collectively, and Jews never speak of Bukurim, what you would find is that I'm unaware of any Jewish writings that ascribe anything more to Pesach and matzah than a celebration of Jewish history and the exodus from Egypt.
No, that's what's taught. Everybody repeats that to you.
But yeah, there's no association with Pesach is the doorway to God's home, to eternal life. Matzah is the welcome mat where we are perfected, vindicated, cleansed of rabbinic, religious, and political corruption. And Bukurim is where we're adopted into God's family. I have never seen any Jewish site explain any of that. And
they claim Bukurim has to do with what do they call it? Noahide laws. That's what they call them. And they don't do that. That's not for them. That's for the goy. They say
yeah.
That's not for us.
What's a Noahide law?
Yeah,
something they made up.
The answer is there isn't any such thing, which is why you don't know about them. But there is a religious zeal for creating laws out of instructions, and where there are no instructions, then it is that is particularly ripe ground for law creation. So, since there are no laws of any kind associated with Noah, I mean, the law of the ark is that it must be these dimensions, or the daggone thing will capsize. But you know, that's
called the law of listening to instructions.
That is called the law of
guidance.
Instructions, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
but so what they did is they assumed that there was a covenant with Noah, so therefore there must be Noah laws, and the Noahide laws are imagined laws associated with Noah. Is that correct, Larry?
Yeah, it's all rabbinic BS. It's just more of the brought to you by we're Jewish and it's our Torah, so we can make anything up we feel like.
Yeah, so one of the things that's also interesting about filling in where there is nothing, the Jews, if they were asked to justify the reason for the Talmud, the first thing that they provide, you know, after saying, well, you know, there's no way that mere mortals can understand the Torah as was given to Moses, so rabbis have to interpret it for you. Now, once you get by the gobbledygook and you say, okay, come on, that's ridiculous that they're using the same words, and in essence you're saying that these rabbis are better communicators than is God himself. And so I'm not buying that. So what is the real reason for the Talmud? And you know what they explain? It's because God did not provide sufficient instructions on kosher. In fact, we've been through this before. If you go through God's instructions on what is good and what's not good, what you end up is recognizing that it's impossible to follow them based upon the description that is given, and the Dabarim, God goes and says, you know, eat whatever you want, so long as you're thoughtful about it. And so there isn't any way to be kosher from a dietary point of view based upon the Torah. And what we've come to conclude is there's a reason for that. It has very little to do with food and has, much to do with what we consume, with that which is healthy and nourishing and that which is poisonous. Being the Torah and the prophets are nourishing, the Word of God is nourishing, and the Word of men is poisonous. And that was at least that's the conclusion most of us have drawn when we've studied the basis of what's called kosher. But for religious Jews, that was not satisfactory. So they've looked at God's omission in this regard of not being specific on what you can eat, and decided that the Dabarim, eat whatever you want so long as you're thoughtful about it, is unacceptable, because that's way too liberating. And so they have created a religion about what you can and cannot eat. You know, the same thing is true with they'll go on to say with the Shabbat. You know, God just says don't do your ordinary work and don't attempt to do the work, and they'll never put together malak and malaka. Same word, it's just the feminine of malak, so it's the feminine spiritual messenger, of which there is only one. That's the set apart spirit. Don't attempt to do her work. And on this day, and so they must have 100 laws about the Shabbat, because God evidently was not facilitating enough. Yeah, it wasn't clear and wasn't limiting enough. So, they have the Shabbat law of the phone and light switch and elevator button, which God somehow neglected.
You know, in this past week when I was working on all the way up to today on Proverbs, and I looked in the words, I mean, really looked up everything. Mm-hmm. It was so amazing how a little word, like somewhere down the road we'll talk about a word, and he starts out a sentence with a pun, that we translate a pun, and that seems real simple. And then you go and look at the ancient Hebrew, and then you go and look at all these other Genesis, lexicons and all, and you'll find even the simplest little conjunctions or prepositions and all that he uses are just rife with meaning that you didn't even know was there until you look them up. I mean, this thing is the best communicator in the world. I don't know. You couldn't put this together in a million, billion years.
Yeah. Well, you know, that translation you did for me, Kirk, was amazing.
Uh-huh.
I loved it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and you wrote, you did it like a 3-page explanation on one.
Yeah, I don't know how to talk about this simply.
Well, no, I'm hearing
issues too.
That's not your style, man. But it was well done. It was beautiful. We took a psalm where the guy was, he was walking into Yahweh's temple and bowing and praying and praising and doing whatever other horse shit the religious people do, and then we broke the words down, or Kirk did rather, and it was beautiful, and it was well done. I just wanted to thank you for that too.
Well, you're quite welcome.
Yeah, it's I'm in the midst of translating the middle or towards the end of the second chapter of Yahshua Isaiah, and there's three statements where Yahweh's against cedars in Lebanon and oaks in Bashan, and it goes on and on, all these things he's against. And you say, no, why would God be against a tree? I mean, trees don't have souls. They don't have consciences. They can't do anything on their own. Why would he be against a tree, for crying out loud? You know, what in the world is a cedar of Lebanon and an oak in Bashan? And then you start peeling back the layers of what these words mean and why they're chosen. And oh, my. I mean, I ended up writing 3 pages on just this is what he was really saying here. And, you know, you've got to be willing to put in the time and to recognize that there are some things that are symbolic and that you need to look at them symbolically. And, you know, for example, here's this is, and so upon and against all the, and then it's Eretz, which is typically translated cedars. But it's actually also the strong and established. It's a projection of power.
Mm-hmm. Now, where are we at here?
I'm just sharing something. This is, I haven't even shared with anyone. I was doing it today. This is Yashaya 2:13. And it says, of Lebanon. Now, Lebanon is to whitewash and to pave over. So he's against the projection of power, which whitewashes and paves over. The high and overbearing and haughty, the exalted and honored, and against all of the mighty, the religious worship of the mighty, who induce others into the religious worship of Allah as if he was the greatest. This is from Alon, and has nothing to do with oaks. It's the strong hand of idolatry, the promotion of false gods, the site and symbol of pagan religious shrines from Allah, meaning larger, greater, and mightiest God, known today as Allah, and related to Alul, which is the incitement to worship a false god based upon someone claiming to have received a revelation from the deity with a message itself being worthless.
By the way, I don't believe I have those translations yet.
No, I didn't shoot them over. I shared it. And then it ends with
beautiful, by the way. I do want to share that. So.
Yeah, and it says of Bashan. And you say, well, where in the hell is Bashan? Well, it's not where is Bashan, it's what is Bashan. Bashan is the Hebrew word for the serpent. God is talking. He's saying, you know, I'm going to bring down political and religious power. That's what I'm going to bring down. I don't like it one bit. And then he goes in that he's going to be against the mountains and the hills. And, the, you know, God's got nothing against mountains and hills. In fact, he's got one mountain that he's got his own. Yeah, he created them. So, you know, he's got nothing against them. But the term that he uses for hill, he uses exactly 7 times. And elsewhere, he speaks of a city on 7 hills.
Mm-hmm.
You know where the city is on 7 hills?
Roma.
Rome. And then, you know, after you do that, then I went into Revelation 17, 18, and 19, and did listen to God tie together the horror, Babylon, Rome, the city on 7 hills, religion, the serpent, Satan, all tied together with a beautiful bow by combining what's written in Isaiah and Daniel. All presented for us very neatly in Revelation 17, 18, and 19, you know, tying everything together. So I'm just sharing that from the point of view that the closer you look, the more masterful the communication becomes, the more interesting it is.
The more accurate the proof, then you start seeing all these prophecy. I mean, look what we've been working on in the last few weeks. And I know there's people out there that get tired of hearing Apollos. Let me tell you something. It's pretty damn important if Yah was putting it out there constantly.
Yes. Constantly. Constantly.
Yes.
Well, you know how many
proof you have? He's saying the same thing about Paul and the church.
Are damned because of Paulos.
It's in the billions.
Today.
It's in the billions.
$2.4 billion today.
That's the other billion that Silver already did.
$2.4 billion throughout history from Paulos.
So you're around $5 billion.
To now, and another $2.4 billion today. It's by two times the world's most popular religion, and it's growing.
You know, China's going Christian. Did you know that? China's going Christian. I was reading. It's set to be the largest Christian country in the world very shortly.
Yes.
Well, I've heard it's a big movement in Africa, as big a movement in Africa.
Yes.
Now, it's not the Baptist type of Christianity, but it's absolutely the Babylonian type of Christianity.
Yeah.
Well, they're all Babylonian.
I mean, you know what I mean, but it's more heavily indoctrinated with...
As a matter of fact, in the Revelation concept, it was just saying that, you know, the people are looking at and listening to the Torahless one, and they're just totally baffled. And he's just reading, of course they're totally baffled, because it was, you know, it was talking about the demon who was and who will be and all that sort of thing, and I just took the time to say, you know, I'm going to figure this out. This can't be that difficult. And, in fact, I'll share it with you, because I really think it's kind of interesting. But what you find is the reason that people are so perplexed as to what's going on here is because the Torahless one is a Pauline Christian.
He's a Christian.
Yeah, they're
Christian
to be the Antichrist, and he is the epitome of the Pauline Christ.
Pro-Christ.
Pro-Christ.
He's a nomos. I get that, you know. Sure.
This is the card.
So I was wrestling Isaiah 2:14. It says, against all of the mountains, the elevated positions, which have sought or ascribed high status for themselves. Now, mountains do not ascribe high status for themselves. That's not room. So we're dealing with a metaphor here. This is not a real mountain. And against all of the hills, this is Gibeah. Hilltops and knolls, which is used exactly seven times to denote seven hills. Judges 7:1, 1 Samuel 23:19, 1 Samuel 26:1, 1 Samuel 26:3, 2 Samuel 2:24, Isaiah 10:32, and Jeremiah 31:39. By the way, it's also a town of Benjamin, which served as a Philistine outpost. For those who...
Is y'all good or what?
Yeah, I know. So these hills, which are exalted and honored. All right, so Rome, the modern incarnation of the Whore of Babylon via Roman Catholicism, is the city on seven hills. It is the only city in the world known to be the city on seven hills. There is no other city in the world on seven hills. So... this is an indictment against Christianity. Now, if I may turn your attention to the revelation of Jaokanan, the 17th chapter speaks of the malignancy which emanates from the city on seven hills. While tying Satan, the whore, Babylon, Rome, Roman Catholicism together as a singular menace to humankind, one with a limited life. And here it just is... What it says is some of my commentary on it. It says, and one of the seven messengers who has the seven bowls came and spoke with me. This would be with Jaokanan, saying, come here. I shall show you the judgment of the whore who sits on many waters. Many waters is who influences many Gentile nations. And with whom the rulers of the earth commit acts of immorality. And those who dwell on the earth are intoxicated with the wine of her immorality. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet. Let me change this. I found a mistake here. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast full of blasphemous names. The Lord, the God, Jesus Christ, Allah, throughout of you. Having seven heads and ten horns, which is a reference to Daniel's prophecy concerning the beast that grows out of Imperial Rome to trample the whole earth. And the woman was clothed in purple and scarlet, which are the colors of human institutional power and death, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a cup full of abominations, which would to be religious concoctions, and the unclean things of her immorality. And upon her forehead a name was written. So now we're talking about, you know, the whore. We've spent the entire program here now for 3 months talking about who the whore is. I mean, William the Elevator Man wrote us and said, you know, who is the whore being depicted in Proverbs 6? And then the whore emerges here in Proverbs 7. Well, God in Revelation 17 says the whore has a name written on her forehead. And this is the name of the whore written on her forehead: Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. The whore is religion, and particularly the religions that grew out of Babylon. And there is no religion more Babylonian than Christianity. Since understanding the connection between the whore, Babylon, and Satan, and how their influences manifest today is the purpose of what we've been covering, we are right in the thick of things. And then it goes on and says, And I saw the woman was drunk with the blood of the set apart, and with the blood of the witnesses of Yahusha. And when I saw her, I wondered greatly. So the messenger said to me, why are you wondering? You know, this is, again, God's nature. Yahochanan should have known, right? Yahochanan spent 3 years with Yahusha. Why in the heck is he saying, I don't get it. Who is this woman? Why is the whore being called Mystery Babylon? Now, why do you think that the messenger said, why are you confused? Why don't you understand this?
Well, he thought he would know. He's right there in the northern part of Israel, on the Greek peninsula.
The reason that he should know is the question that he asked is answered in Daniel.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Daniel explains all of this. See,
yeah.
So all he had to do is read Daniel, and he would have understood, because Daniel was speaking.
Well,
so
yeah, but, you know, I mean, let's face it, it's probably easier for you and me to understand now than it would have been for him then, too.
Correct.
The Catholic Church really didn't have its grip. I do understand that, you know, there was the Lord Baal and Babylon and all that, and then and the national lunar deity was Sin, who was worshipped in the form of a crescent moon.
Okay.
You know, like
you and I, we've all been in this group. We've been studying Yahweh's testimony now for 10 to 15 years.
Right.
Yep.
You know, we've come to learn a lot.
Yep.
Yahochanan lived 724. With the living manifestation of the Torah, Yahusha.
That's right. Yeah.
He really, I mean, the messenger cut him no slack. That's Yahweh's way. Why are you asking me that question? You know, don't you know? When Nicodemus says, you know, I don't get it. What did God say? How is it you don't get it? You're a teacher of the Torah. You know. So anyway, I just think it's always interesting to see God's perspective on this. He expects more of us than we typically deliver. Okay.
Yeah, well, that's probably true too. Yeah.
Well, he says, so I shall tell you.
What kills me is how people miss it today. I mean, when you're literally
conclusions, and it's so clear. It's just amazing that you can be a Christian in light of this. It says, I shall tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, again, that's a direct reference to Daniel. And the beast that you saw was and is not, and is about to come out of the abyss and go to destruction. And those who dwell on the earth will wonder, whose name has not been, those whose name has not been written on the book of the life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast, that he was and is not and will come. So if you're not a member of the covenant family, you're going to wonder and say, I don't get any of this. Doesn't make sense to me. If you are part of the covenant family, what the messenger is saying is you ought to be able to figure it out. But I read that and I said, they don't get it. I don't get it. Christians don't get it. But if you are in the covenant, you ought to be able to get it. So I figured this can't be that hard. So he's saying that this beast, which is a demon, was, is not, is about to come out of the abyss and will go to destruction. Mm-hmm. All right. Since this godly encounter between Yohanan and Yosha and the and Yosha's spiritual representatives took place sometime in 66 CE, the demonic spirit which had possessed Shaul by his own admission 3 decades prior to this revelation in 36 CE had just returned to the abyss following Paul's death earlier that same year, thereby explaining was and is not. Paul was Yohanan's most nefarious foe. The same demon, however, would emerge to possess Hadrian 6 decades later when he destroyed Jerusalem so that he could rename it after himself and then erect a shrine, deifying himself on the Temple Mount between 126 and 136 CE. Now, is there any place in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms that says Hadrian was possessed by the same demon? No. But it's obvious. Mm-hmm. This most vile of satanic messengers would then possess Muhammad in 610 CE, creating Islam. But that is not the last we will see of this satanic envoy. The dark spirit who possessed Paul, and Paul is certain, Hadrian, likely, and Muhammad, almost certain, will return to possess the Torahless one, known to many as the Antichrist. And since this demon is the living embodiment of religion and politics, those who do not know God will be scratching their heads befuddled as to why the Antichrist will have so much in common with these revered individuals. So then the messenger went on and said, here is the mind which has wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sits. That's a reference to the 7 mountains identifies Roman Catholicism as the power against which God is in opposition in the Yeshaya 2:14 passage we just read. And there are 7 rulers. 7 rulers in this city with 7 mountains. 7 rulers. 5 have fallen as of 68 CE. 1 is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain for a little while. All right. He's speaking of Rome. This is a reference to the 5 imperial Roman rulers who had fallen. Specifically, Julius, deceased 44 BCE. Augustus, deceased 14 CE. Tiberius, deceased 37 CE. Caligula. Boy, these are really good demonic guys. They, every one of them claimed to be God. Caligula, 41 CE. Claudius, deceased 54 CE. I count that as 5. Julius, Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius. 5 Roman emperors who had died. 5 have fallen. The imperial Roman ruler still alive at the time of the revelation was?
Nero.
Oh, another good demonic fellow. Nero. Deceased 68 CE. Now it says that one is, so 5 have fallen, 1 is, that would be Nero, and the other has not yet come. Now, but when he comes, he will remain a little while. Well, Galba, Otho, and Vitellius were all killed in 69. Not even one of them ruled for as much as 3 months. So we can skip them. And you look to Vespasian, 69 to 79 CE. Now, Vespasian, he came all right, didn't he? He's the one who had not yet come, but would come, and that he would remain a little while. Come he would. Under his leadership, 3 Roman legions invaded Yehuda and then destroyed Yahweh's temple. His son Titus would haul the treasure away, using it to finance the Roman Colosseum, the ultimate shrine to immorality. The revolt against Roman taxation, which initiated the invasion, commenced in the year of this revelation, 66 CE, when Rome plundered Yahweh's temple and then bought the brought the brunt of the Legion 12, which is Fuminata, against Yehuda. The very year the revelation to Yehuchanan occurred. Now, how's that for precision? And this is precision now in a text that was translated from Hebrew to Greek, and it's still precise. And people are all trying to figure out, who is this? Who is he talking? It's just so easy. I mean, it falls right into your lap as to who he's talking about, meaning that that demon was the very demon that possessed Paul. And the beast which was and is not is himself also an eighth, and is one of the seven, and he goes to destruction. Since this is Revelation 17:11, since the beast is a reference to one of Satan's demons and its influence, the one which was and is not depicts the demon which until just recently had possessed Paul. And since it was also an eighth, this is a reference to the demonic spirit who would later possess Hadrian, then Muhammad, and ultimately the Torahless one, going to destruction upon Yahweh's return in 2033. Now, the reason this demon is mentioned as one of the seven is because Hadrian and the Torahless one represent the beasts of Imperial Rome, which evolved into Roman Catholicism. This is the essence of Mystery Babylon. So, if some of the terminology is a bit confusing, you know, for those who have recently read the seventh volume of Yad Eliyahu, Daniel's revelation regarding the beast of Roman Catholicism and how it evolved from Imperial Rome is presented there. And it evolved from Greece, Persia, and Babylon over a millennia, beginning in 539 CE to 395 CE with the reign of Theodosius, the last emperor to rule over Eastern and Western Rome, and the first Caesar to impose Roman Catholicism on the entire Roman Empire. Now, the upcoming evolution from the imposition of the Roman Catholic Church to the political power manifest by the Torahless one is then explained using the terminology first presented to Daniel between his arrival in Babylon in 605 BCE and the empire's destruction in 539 BCE. This is addressing the period from 2026 to 2033 CE. And the ten horns, which you saw, are ten rulers who have not yet received a kingdom, but they will receive authority as rulers with the beast for 1 hour. These have one purpose, and they give their power and authority to the beast, but they will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. And he said to me, "The waters which you saw, where the whore sits, are the multitudes of Gentiles of different nations and different languages. And the ten horns which you saw, and the beast, these will hate the whore, and will make her desolate and naked, will eat her flesh, and will burn her up with fire." That's one of the things that you can count on when it comes to the whore and her minions, is that they are in it for themselves, and they will all turn on one another. "And the woman whom you saw is the great city, which reigns over the rulers of the earth." Now, since Rome no longer rules over kings, and since the Vatican has limited political influence, the city which reigns over the earth's rulers is Babylon. Babylon, after
yeah, but they
all,
do.
Is not
by
the name
way,
of a country,
I
the name of a city.
Saw a picture. I recently saw a picture of Putin going in and kissing the ring of the Pope. So, I mean, they really do. I think I know you and I kind of disagree on this. I think they hold a lot more political sway over the political landscape of the actors in the Western democracies than maybe you do. I really think that. I think they put their weight behind certain candidates.
Yeah, I think that there was a time where the Roman Catholic Church and political authority were inseparable in Europe. And they're one and the same.
Well, there certainly was.
Political authority.
But I think there's a lot more power than you give credit to right now.
I think the fall of the Holy Roman Empire, Roman Catholicism's political hold has dwindled. But, you know, when you have 1.2 billion members, you have lots of influence over politicians who require the votes of Roman Catholics. And so the blessing of the Pope is considered a really good thing if you're a political leader. It gives you credibility. That's why Bernie Sanders, a communist, is heading there. You know, it's interesting. Bernie Sanders didn't want to speak to Netanyahu, didn't want to speak to any Jew. So what he did, you know, communists, secular humanists hate Jews, Christians hate Jews, Muslims hate Jews. What is the common denominator between man's religions? They hate Jews. So Sanders appointed a liaison to court to the Jewish vote. And the first thing the liaison said is that Netanyahu is a a-hole. That he is a despicable human being, a master of lies who has created a genocide in Palestine. So much for that.
Yeah, I saw that. And by the way, I think Bernie's campaign slogan should be from each according to his ability to each according to his name or whatever.
Which really should be restated. From the productive we will punish and steal, and to the unproductive we will make dependence.
Well, you can't steal a whole lot from unproductive.
Yeah.
No, but you can make them dependent.
And the productives aren't enough of the productives to elect anybody.
Yeah.
So
not a good plan. It's really not a good plan.
Yeah, but you know, the guy who is touting the economic fairness has never had a job in his life.
Yeah.
Isn't that the same old, same old? I mean, all these guys they put up there as president, even if they have had a job, it's usually been handed to them by daddy and all that. I mean, look at the current guy who's got his ass parked in the White House. Who claimed to have been a professor. He was an adjunct is what he was, which is like saying I'm a nothing. And what he went in and talked about was race. That was his
whole thing. When was the last time America elected a businessman?
They don't elect businessmen that I'm aware of.
No, I mean, if Trump actually wins the Republican nomination, and he wins, he'll be the first actual businessman to hold the office. And, I mean, I don't know how far you'd have to go back to find another businessman.
Probably forever. Probably never.
Maybe forever. Maybe forever. All right, so then the religion whose Bible contains this revelation will fall along with its inspiration. It's ironic that Christians seldom consider the implications of the words which follow. And this is now from Revelation 18. After these things, I saw another messenger coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried out in a mighty voice, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great," which means that Babylon, up to that point, has held sway. And she has become a dwelling place of, what do you think? The
harlots. Harlots, horns.
Demons. Demons of satanic
messages. She's already a place of harlots.
Babylon is a dwelling place for demons and a prison for every unclean spirit. Yes, there are spirits that are not of God. And a prison of every unclean and hated bird of prey. For all of the Gentile nations have drunk the wine of the passion of her immorality, and the rulers of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have become filthy rich with the wealth of her sensuality. I heard another voice, and by sensuality means seductiveness, and I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her sins, and that you may not receive her plagues." Huh. What is the plague of death?
That's Paulos. The plague of
Paulos, Pauline Christianity is the plague of death. Come out of her, my people. He's talking about this nation, this entity from the city on seven hills. This entity that grew out of Rome, where he's very specific of the five emperors that were, the one that was, the one that will come. He's talking about the entity that grew out of the Roman Empire to tread down the entire earth that was the realm of demons. And he says, come out of her, my people. That's Roman Catholicism, which, by the way, you know, I want to be really careful here. Because I think there are a lot of Protestant Christians that think, oh, well, that's Roman Catholicism. Oh, yeah. Not a Roman Catholic. There isn't a tinker's dam worth of difference between Christianity and Roman Catholicism. I mean, not only is Roman Catholicism 1.2 billion Christians, but Protestant Christianity is 99% Roman Catholicism.
And yeah, I mean, ultimately, that's true. Just because you say the Pope isn't my man, and then you follow the same everything.
Yeah, and the same religion.
It doesn't even matter, even if you use the same names and you carry the same book, and you have the same principles, which let's face it, a church. Yahweh has
it's like
to do with
it's like Sunni and Shia Islam. Exactly the same religion, different leaders. Same book.
Right. Right.
Different leaders, same religion.
And these Jehovah's Witnesses or Seventh-day Adventists can say, oh, see, we're the ones that are different. No, you're not. You're
they're
walking
not,
around.
Does it matter
who they named with the names they use with a church? A church. I mean, first of all, if there's a church associated with it, it's wrong.
You're Christian.
I mean, period.
Man, every one of them calls themselves Christian. This is Christianity, which is God is saying, come out of her, my people. He's telling them to come out of Christianity. He's not telling them to come out of Islam. That's a waste of time. He's not telling them to come out of socialist secular humanism. He's telling them to come out of Babylon. Otherwise, you'll receive her plagues. For her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back as she has paid. Give her back double according to her deeds. In the cup which he has mixed twice as much for her. And to the degree that she glorified herself and lived seductively, to the same degree, give her torment and mourning. For she says in her heart, I sit as a queen, and I am not a widow. I will never see mourning. Yeah, the Queen of Heaven, the Mother of God, who is now embodied in Roman Catholicism. For this reason, in one day, her plagues will come, pestilence and mourning and famine, and she will be burned up with fire, for Yahweh, who judges, is powerful. And the king of the earth, who committed acts of immorality and lived sensuously with her, will weep and lament over her when he sees the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance because of the fear of the torment, saying, woe, woe, to the great city of Babylon, the mighty city, for in one hour your judgment has come. Your merchants were the great men of the earth. Boy, I tell you what, it's hard not to see the conspiracy here between the elitists, the merchants and the bankers and the international corporations and the politicians and the military-industrial complex. And those who are trading in oil and that is what is being talked about here. Your merchants were the great men of the earth because all the Gentile nations were deceived by your sorcery. And in her was found the blood of the prophets and the set apart, all of whom had been slain on the earth. And this starts Revelation 19. And after these things, I heard, as it were, a loud voice of the great multitude in heaven saying, Hallelujah, radiate Yah's light. You know, how could you be a Christian and not figure out that, oh, wait a minute, that means to radiate Yah's light. There's a God named Yahweh. That's what they're saying in Hebrew.
Oh, well, salvation. The reason that you could do that is because you don't know this. You're not on social media, but they'll run around saying hallelujah all day. I've asked several dozen, what does that mean? And they say, well, it means praise God. They don't even know what it means. And of course, I straighten them out. I said, no, that means radiate Yahweh's light. It's a combination of halal and Yahweh. They don't know what that is.
Then quoting Psalm 19:9, it said, because his judgments are true and right, for he has judged the great whore who is corrupting the earth with her immorality, and he has avenged the blood of his servants for her, a citation of Devarim 16:6. And the second time they said, hallelujah, radiate Yahweh's light. Her smoke rises up forever and ever. So, if there was any question as to who the whore is, and the whore is going to appear in Proverbs 7 again. The whore was in Proverbs 6. Who the whore is should be gone. The whore, Satan, Babylon, Rome, and Christianity are all one entity. And,
yeah, they absolutely
I used to have a more open view of this and to say, you know, that the whore of Babylon also includes socialist secular humanism and Islam.
Islam, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
They all run.
I think that the whore of Babylon is Christianity, Roman Catholicism. That's what I think it is. I don't think it goes beyond that.
No.
It's capital is the city on seven hills. The only thing that's Babylonian about Islam is that the first writing of the Quran took place in outside of Babylon, because of course the Arabs were illiterate, so the only people that could actually write it down were the first literate people conquered by the Muslims, which were the Persians. And so the first written copy of the Quran was written down in Babylon. But that doesn't make the religion of Islam any more Babylonian than Judaism is Babylonian, because the first copy of the Babylonian Talmud was written in Babylon. And so while the whore permeates all religions, when Yahweh goes to this explicit nature to say, five kings were, one is, one is yet to come, and then there is an eighth, and it's all of this takes place on the city on seven hills. He's talking about Roman Catholicism. That's what he was talking about.
Sure, of course he is. Of course he is. I've always thought that.
Is Christianity?
Yeah.
Full stop.
Sure it is. Yeah. Okay. Let me look. I want to just address something you said. You read that, and you said, oh, well, you know, how easy does it got to be? Five are gone, okay. One is current, and one is yet to come.
Right.
And he'll only
remain
a little while.
All I had to do is Google Roman empires, emperors, and you look at them. And, okay, I counted them. How many were deceased at that point? There were five.
Yes. Yes, and you are a top-notch researcher.
Nero died the following year.
You are absolutely excellent. But let me tell you, I would have been befuddled, as I'm sure most people that are in the chat room had never figured that out. Now that you've told us, sure, that's easy. You know, it's like an alphabet. You know, doing the alphabet at this point, because you already you went and figured
that. I am quite positive that, Kirk, if you had read that, you would have gone and done exactly what I did.
Really?
And you would have said, boy, there are five of them that are gone. There's one that currently is. They were all demonic. And there's one that's coming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then you look at the one that's coming. He was the only one that really came. He was Vespasian. The rest of them never made it to Israel. But, oh, Vespasian, he sure as hell did.
Yeah.
It's not hard, but the advantage of knowing the timing, some people may not have done this, there is no telling exactly when Paul died, but no one has Paul living past 68. And it's obvious that Revelation was written no later than 68, because 68 is when the great revolt between Rome and Yehuda began, and it was in the very end of 68 that the first of three legions was brought to bear against Jerusalem. And 2 years later, of course, the temple was torn down. There is no way the revelation of Yahuconan wouldn't have mentioned those events had they already occurred. So yeah, it's obvious that Yahuconan wrote this later than 68 CE. And then all you have to do is look up, when did Paul die? And the consensus of every site you look at, because you know Paul describes his timeline and Acts presents Paul's timeline, is that Paul dies in either late 67 or early 68. I mean, it is, and so when you do that, it becomes obvious that the demon that he's talking about, was and is not,
I believe,
is the demon that possessed Paul.
Yeah. Oh, by the way,
Yahuconan would have known, because Paul was the most overt demon in his life.
Well, by the way, over in Chabawook, where Yah was describing Paulos, and he says that he at the behest of another, or at the prodding of another, or words to that effect. I was thinking about that today, and I thought the other is the demonic spirit that possessed
him. Yeah, the best of another. Yeah, the best
that's
of another.
The other one is.
Yeah,
on the advice
exactly.
of another. That's on the advice
of another.
He's
talking about the same demon.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So,
exactly.
I mean, that's
and
what
by the
I,
way, the reference to the seven hills, one of them was in Chabaouk and was specifically referencing the source of Paul's power. Got it, Mr. Trek. You know, it's all there if you choose to consider it. So let's.
From a prophetic point of view, this is huge. And by the way, I thought. You know, I did a note on God, or on Paulos, his dead God, and his ridiculous counterfeit. And you know the part in here in the Mashal where he's talking about, and I brought this up last week, but I just thought it was so profound, where he talks about how this person, and of course he names him as Sheol later, but I mean how his religion is worshiping a piece of wood and says that's going to give him life in the end.
If
that's a total description of Christianity, they're at the foot of the cross. I mean, forget the fact that they counterfeited Strayos or upright.
How many times does Paul say that, you know, their salvation is in the cross?
And a piece of wood. On a piece of wood did this, not the Torah.
Yeah,
not
and
the
in fact,
plan,
even
no.
a phony piece of wood, because there was no
no cross.
There was no cross.
Go big or stay at home.
Member,
you know,
of the Roman means of crucifixion, it was not set below the top of the upright. It was set on top of the upright.
You were on.
Not
it was
lower.
Put on top.
It was a capital T, not a lowercase T. The Christian cross, you know, it looked like actually the very letter that the Babylonians used to convey Tammuz's name.
Yep, it sure did.
There's
people that run around. There's people that run around and you know the Tav, you know the
yeah.
mark.
Right.
They run around saying, God used the Tav. And you're sitting there going, oh, man, you are such an ass.
Yeah.
You know,
and what the Tav means is that there is a legacy of it. There's almost a legacy of everything in Hebrew in today's world. When an illiterate person signs something, how do they sign it?
Signature is an X. It's an X. That's exactly what it is.
The Tav means signature. It's the sign of a signature. That's what it means.
Yeah, and
there
they turn
no,
it into a cross.
No connotation whatsoever of a cross. It's a sign of a signature.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know, but that's what they've done. They've taken the tav. That's a
yeah.
signature.
And of course, one of the other problems we have within Christianity is that is there any reference to a cross even in the Christian New Testament?
No, Strauss.
Strauss, upright pole. And there's a
yeah, well,
reference
I mean,
to
there is
an upright pole in the Torah. It's the Edom. It's the upright pole of the tabernacle. It sets into the foundation of the tabernacle, and it holds the roof of the tabernacle up.
And the covering.
Yep. So it's to enlarge it and make it secure. And Yahweh identifies it with his home regularly, but it's an upright pillar.
Okay, but you're speaking from
pillar.
A person who has understanding and has actually looked at the words, just like you did in these words in Revelation, and have seriously considered them and went out and studied. And what they're doing is they're trying to advance a religion that they happen to believe in. And you know, that's
yeah.
two different things we're talking about
right.
here.
Yeah.
One's
now,
real, one's
what I was
not.
Trying to do in this whole thing, I stated my purpose and covering the first 14 chapters of Yashayah was that I wanted absolute and definitive proof. Now that William had introduced us to the whore in Proverbs 6, and that the whore was obviously associated with Pauline Christianity because Proverbs 6 was primarily about Paul. The whore reappears in Proverbs 7, which specifically names Shaul. And so while it was obvious to me that the whore was associated with Pauline Christianity, I wanted definitive proof that the whore, Babylon, Pauline Christianity, and Satan were all one and the same. And Yashayah, going through the 14th chapter, ties all those things together. But here, the 17th and 18th chapter of Revelation do exactly the same thing. And it says that Roman Catholicism, Pauline Christianity, the plague of death, the whore, and Babylon are all one and the same. And from a prophetic point of view, Larry, you are correct. That's a really big deal.
It's a huge deal. It's a huge deal, and it's what we're seeing. Yeah, have you ever noticed, and you know, I mean, this is just right in line. We're watching prophecy unfold in front of our eyes. Yeah, you'll see as an example, Obama will come out and say something about gun control. Merkel will come out and say something about gun control. And then the next thing you hear is the Pope saying something about gun control. They're all tied
yeah.
together.
Yeah, Cameron says that we shouldn't exit the European Union. So the abomination is over there, and he's saying, oh, boy, you better not exit the European Union, because even though you're our most favorite ally, you're going to go to the rear of the bus in terms of future trade deals if you do, which is just an absolute
lie. Why do we have left to trade?
They all carry the same junk. But, Larry, when you read the tie-in between the kings, the rulers, the merchants,
yes,
and Roman Catholicism, and not only in Revelation, but elsewhere, and mm-hmm. Yashayah, your conclusion that the influence of Rome economically, politically, and religiously is greater than I give it credit.
I think so. I really think so.
That's what God is saying.
Yeah.
The influence of the 1.2 billion people and the entity that is Christianity at large has.
I mean, you take Bank of America, you know, the Jesuits, which is just another arm of the Vatican. The Jesuits bought Bank of America a couple years ago. You know, I mean,
well, Bank of America was merged into Nations Bank, you know, so Bank of America failed. And so because it was too large to collapse, they simply merged Bank of America into Nations Bank. And since Nations Bank and Bank of America, if you looked at the two, Bank of America was a better name than Nations Bank. The company that they were merged into changed their name to Bank of America. But Bank of America actually doesn't exist anymore.
It's largely owned by the Jesuits, or at least that move was, and I'll bet you they made a lot of money on it. But my point is, these guys are into control of a lot of things, and you know, behind the scenes and everything. The World Bank, the UN, the World Health Organization. That's completely Vatican, you know. These are just Vatican organizations, and they're respected by the world, aren't they? And the world's leaders.
Yeah. No, clearly the Vatican is behind the mythical people known as the Palestinians. The Pope is stunningly and has been anti-Semitic for a very, very long time. And this particular Pope is a communist, and so he is aligned himself with the liberal leaders worldwide, and for the first time ever, America gave a political audience to the Pope. You know, it is on his disgusting white robes, and by the way, Lebanon speaks of wearing white robes. Okay. My son, literally and continue to observe my words, my answers, and my promises, specifically my instructions and the conditions for participating in the relationship, electing to continually store them within you as a genuine treasure. And you shall genuinely and continuously live by closely examining and carefully considering my directions and conditions of the binding relationship agreement and with my Torah teaching, in accord with the center and focus of your eye. Choose to fasten them onto your fingers of your own volition and engrave them on the tablets of your heart. Elect to say to wisdom, you are my sister and my wise friend whom I know, acknowledge, and recognize. You should choose to call upon and summon understanding. By being observant, you will be protected from the illegitimate, estranged, unauthorized, sickening, and repugnant woman, away from the whore's seductive words and deceitful promises. Well, now we know. Yahweh told us the whore is Babylon, is Roman Catholicism. You want to be protected from Roman Catholicism? Study the Torah. It's the only antidote. There is no other antidote. And he was very specific, because what is the central aspect of the whore's claim that there is a new covenant and a new testament to go along with that new covenant? So Yahweh said, you not only need to observe my Torah and treasure it, but specifically the terms and conditions of my covenant agreement, my mitzvah. The only antidote there is for Christianity. Away from the whore's seductive words and deceitful promises. For in and by the window, this is where we were last week. In and by the window.
In and by the window would mean somebody that was local to it. It was, you know,
right.
It was Paulo's.
Of my house. This is
John
speaking. By the window of my house, through the lattice denoting the proper timing of things, from a higher elevation, I looked down and I saw her. And then with her were the simple-minded and naive, ha-petty, the easily deceived, malleable, and readily persuaded, the ignorant and irrational, with deficient judgment, the foolish, from pathoth, airheads who are gullible, simply enticed, readily misled and betrayed. That's Yahweh's idea of pejorative language. And I made the connection, understanding and recognizing among the children a young man of deficient character, lacking judgment. Yep. So the first of the 5 points that God is making is subtle and easily missed, but you jumped right on it, Larry. Is that the whore, Christianity, operates right outside of God's home. Outside, for sure, but right outside. And that's because there would be no credibility for any religion if they didn't usurp Yahweh's credibility. After all, the whore is Satan. And the whore creates religion for a specific purpose. What is the reason the whore creates religion?
Guys,
to bind you. Oh,
it's a mislead. Wait. To kill you. To kill you. To kill your soul. So you,
no,
so
that's,
you make
that's
poor
a byproduct
choices.
Separate
the
reflection. That's a byproduct. Pardon?
Okay.
He won't see his byproduct. The relationship with him.
Oh, you're saying because he wants, you're saying the whore wants to be worshipped as God. Well, of course.
That is correct. The reason the whore creates religion based upon Yahweh's testimony and a corruption of Yahweh's testimony is the whore knows who's God, wants to be worshipped as if he were God, and the only way to accomplish that is to position
look
himself
like God.
As the God. And the only way to do that is to position everything he does right outside of Yahweh's testimony. Otherwise, there's no way to fool people into worshiping him as God. Why is Islam based on a corruption of the Torah?
Same reason.
Because Allah wants to be worshipped as God. Yep. That's why Christianity lurked right outside Yahweh's covenant home. And, you know, they didn't come up with, we're going to have a totally different religion. No, they said we're going to have a new covenant, which is just a update of the old covenant. Right
based on
God
what
God.
Was real, we're going to counterfeit that. It's like you said, you don't, you know, you don't hand somebody a pink $100 bill, counterfeit $100
right.
bill,
and no
expect
to
get away with it.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Particularly if you want to pass it off as real, Satan wants to be passed off as God. The only way to do that is to corrupt Yahweh's testimony and place his corruptions right outside of God's home, right next to it. Now, there's 5 points here that are made in this statement, which is Proverbs 7, 6, and 7. First is subtle, which is that having encouraged us to observe his Torah, which is to closely examine it, he now speaks of a window, an opening designed for the passage of light. So, in Proverbs 6, which is related, the Torah was called light, and windows work both ways. God can see us through it, and we can see him. You want to see God? Look through the perspective provided by the Torah. But because God sees us, and that would include you, Larry, through the perspective of the Torah, you look perfect. Imagine
that's
that.
Good to know. That's good to know.
Yeah.
I need to help over here. I really do.
So that's what he's saying, is that he's looking at you through the light of the Torah. Now, second, the Torah presents Ba'ad Ishnab, the rightful of order of things and their proper timing. This is that the lattice of the window. It means that God looked out his perspective from the proper timing and the rightful order of things. By reading Yahweh's testimony in the order he presented it, the reader is empowered to make an informed and rational decision regarding God and all of time. Everything falls into place. It all makes sense. The timing and purpose of Eden, the flood, the covenant, the Exodus, the Torah,
the Yobel,
are known as is that of Jerusalem and Yisrael, of the menace of Babylon, the rabbis, the cure provided by Yosha through the Mikre, of the deadly alternative presented by Shaul, Rome, and Roman Catholicism, all leading to the Torahless one. And to the ultimate fall of the whore of Babylon, culminating in with Yahweh's return to restore his covenant. Every step forward and backward along the way, including those still future, can be known, they can be understood, and they can be dated. That's what God is saying by his description of this window in his home. The lattice on that window presents the proper timing and order of things. There's nothing random. You know, the Torah the Quran is a jumbled mess. There's no context. There's no chronology. With God, there is a rightful order and a proper order of things. And he has provided us with all of the framework to figure it out. Does God want to? Third, Yahweh affirmed that knowledge and understanding represent the means to life in the Proverbs first five statements. Now, by contrast, in the sixth and the seventh, he is acknowledging that ignorance and gullibility are the elixirs of religion. That's the thing that you come across every day, Larry. Knowing is a product of proof. Yahweh can be known which is, you know, which is absolutely essential to all of this. Yahweh can be known.
Can I throw something in here? I did a post on exactly this. You know, you think about all these gods. You know, I mean, name a few. It doesn't matter. Amun-Ra, you know, whether it's the Gratia, Amun-Ra, or Lord Baal, or any of these.
Lord God?
Yes, Sin. Name them. It doesn't matter. You know, they all are represented by something that has a limitation. And even the sun has a limitation, of course. Whether it's the sun, the moon, or some fearsome deity with a lightning bolt or perhaps a hammer or whatever.
Jupiter, Zeus, Thor.
And it wouldn't matter. Yeah, but, you know, just the mere fact Yahweh's name is the answer to the question of existence and a dimensional formation. I mean, it's an
he created a language which he communicates with. So, I mean, he really cheated in this regard.
Yeah, well, that's okay. I exist means that time is a matrix, a developed design of a dimension I created. I mean, we cannot.
Yeah.
I've had people ask me the question. Okay, then what was before God? I said, you can only think in terms of beginnings and ends and what was before, but that's the point of Yahweh's name, is I exist. Time is just a dimension. When he made the construct of light, that's when he made time. Time and reality doesn't exist outside this dimension.
When we speak of what was before God, our perspective is from a 3.5 dimensional construct. Now, God is 7-dimensional. And so for a 3.5 dimensional construct to understand what existed in the 7th dimension before the 7th dimension existed
is impossible.
So far beyond our comprehension. We have a very difficult time, and I would say there's probably only, you know, a dozen people at any one time that actually understand 4 dimensions. There isn't a person on the planet today that understands 5 dimensions or 6 dimensions, and most certainly not 7. And so to answer that question, what existed before, let's just say, the 6-dimensional universe, you're dealing with that which exists in 7 dimensions. It's infinitely beyond our capacity to understand.
It would be like handing somebody a book. Let's say I hand them a War and Peace. Okay, and let's say I wrote it. I wrote War and Peace, or at least I wrote
it. Tolstoy.
Okay. I'm just saying. I'm saying you throw it down there, and you go. They go, well, what was before War and Peace?
War and Peace.
It doesn't matter.
Mostly war. Some peace.
Mostly war. My point is, I can read the middle of the book, the end of the book, the start of the book. Let's say I'm Tolstoy and I wrote it. That's my point here.
Hey, you know what Yahweh says is the first thing that's going to be different among humankind when he returns? Speaking of War and Peace.
Well, it's going to be your heart.
A man will no longer commit acts of war.
That's true.
We will no longer have military hardware. We will no longer be taught to fight wars. That first thing he says is different when he returns. After he's eliminated, he comes and he says he's not just eliminating, but he's diminishing the elite, all of the religious and political leaders and military leaders. And then he says the first thing, you know, War and Peace, there'll be no more war.
It's right out the window. I agree with you. I'm just saying that is what we're talking about, because we're going from a 3.5 dimension, I guess you're calling it, a writer of a book to a book which is now 2-dimensional. And
we're
so
clearly in a 6-dimensional universe. It's just that we can only understand 3.5 dimensions of it because we're stuck in time. But you know why? Scientists know that 96% of the universe is comprised of what they call dark matter and dark energy. Now, there is no way to ascribe matter to dark matter, nor energy to dark energy, and neither are dark. It's that these two things represent 96% of the substance and energy of the universe, but they're outside of human understanding. We know that they exist. We have no idea what they are, but more than that, we have no means to ascertain what they are. And so what this is bringing us right back to is that our understanding is limited to about 3.5 dimensions. Dark, what we call dark energy and dark matter, representing at least 96% of the known universe, are things outside of the 3.5 dimensions that we understand, and therefore we're absolutely baffled.
Clueless.
We have no means.
Clueless.
We're clueless. It would be like Mickey and Donald Duck, Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck in Flatland, trying to understand the three-dimensional realm in which Walt Disney existed. They'd have the only thing they could ever see about Walt Disney would be if he drew a line in their world. A line, a two-dimensional entity, is all they could ever see or experience of Walt, where that two-dimensional line intersected Flatland. And these dark energy and dark matter are outside of human understanding because they represent dimensions that are beyond our capacity to understand.
But how amazing is it that Yahweh puts the proof right in his name, I exist? Meaning time isn't real. Time is a construct he made when he invented light. Light and time are the same thing.
Or that the word Hayah reads the same right to left as it does left to right. And that in the middle of Hayah is his hand. And there's only two letters that are repeated in Yahweh's name, the Hey. You'll find both of them in Hayah. And, you know, when Yahweh was in the seventh dimension, the single most important thing for him to convey to the beings that he created in six dimensions is, oh, by the way, I exist. What more important thing could he ever communicate to them than, I'm real, I exist?
Yeah, just right off. I mean, that's it. In other words, there is no beginning. There is no end. Time is a construct. Time is a construct he's saying that he made, and he proves it out. So beyond that, just the name is astounding. I mean, the name is really truly astounding. So I just wanted to point out, I did a post on that this week where I just had to bring that out because his name proves he's not one of the typical religious deities, you know, sporting around a hammer or a lightning bolt.
By the way, what's really interesting is that that unlike false gods or the satanically inspired gods, there's no braggadociousness in his name. It's simply, I exist. It's not I'm great. It's not I'm wonderful. It's not you should fear me. It's not I have a thunder bolt. It's not that I wield a hammer. It's I simply exist. Would you like to get to know me? I exist. I exist. I have a name. My name is Yahweh. And it is based upon I exist. So it is it's a marvelous thing. Now, although we're no longer broadcasting, we still are recording. We should probably finish Proverbs 6 and 7. And the point that I was making, which was the third point of five here, is that there is a huge difference between the Hor and Yahweh, and that Yahweh provides proof of his existence so that he can be known through prophecy, simultaneously proving that his testimony is reliable. But when there is no proof, when evidence is overwhelmingly contrary to the belief system, and when the edicts of a religion, like Christianity, are irrational, faith is required to accept the unsupportable. There is a reason faith and religion are interchangeable and indistinguishable concepts. Belief is the only way to dull the faithful senses sufficiently so that they are no longer bothered by the decaying smell of death emanating from their religion's rotten rubbish. And that's why he calls the religious airheads morons.
You know, one thing that you didn't say in there that strikes me is that he's also the God, the only God, of course, but he's also, he wants you to know. Nobody else wants you to know.
Yeah, he wants you to know. Yeah.
He wants us to do what we're doing and dig as deep as you want and find as much about me as you can dig up.
Right.
Well, Christians are going to make the same claim about their Lord. They will. You know they will. That they study. But they don't really study.
They never come to understand anything.
Well, they come to repeating tripe. Words that were handed to them in a book literally named after two sun goddesses, because Holi was the consort to the Eastern sun god Krishna. So you got two sun goddesses.
Well, I would think that most of the other gods are scared death of you, if there were such a thing, but the man-made gods always have the same man-made characteristic that they're scared to have you free, or scared for you to know anything, because then you can bring them down.
I'm just saying that Christians will debate. You know that. Christians study groups and this and that.
But they don't debate. They will. If you bring up something from God, they'll condemn you as being satanically
heretic. I'm a heretic. I'm a proud heretic.
You know, look in the book that you lug around with you. This is what he says. Now, if you don't like what he says, don't blame me. But they will. So what God is saying is that you have to be a moron to be religious.
Yes, you
that
do.
Is what
I
saying.
Think you do. Yeah, you do. You
That's what
to.
He said. So you have to be, according to God, the religious people, particularly Christians, are airheads. They're thoughtless. They're irrational. They're ignorant. Now, the fourth of five essential insights, which can be gleaned from Proverbs 7, 6, and 7. Is that according to God, and he ought to know, the point that you made is valid, that the whore of religion stalks her prey along the path leading to the covenant and in direct proximity to Yahweh's home. Now, this perspective is profoundly important and very seldom understood. Consider the world's two most popular religions, Christianity and Islam. Both claim that the Torah and prophets are true, and that they were inspired by their God. Both claim the characters presented in the Torah and prophets, and that they performed on the behest of their deity. So rather than being created or presented independently as viable alternatives to Yahweh's Torah offering, they corrupt God's testimony to confuse the unwary through counterfeit. Rather than offer their religious rubbish in a garbage heap where it belongs, they pile their putrid corruptions directly on top of the truth. In this way, the whore of religion usurps Yahweh's credibility, claiming the proofs God has provided as her own, thereby causing the most absurd lies to appear plausible, even believable. And the closer the whore can make her counterfeit appear, the more can fool with her bogus bill. This is the appeal of Christianity and Islam. It is the reason that Satan created those religions. There are very few things more important to understand in that perspective. Who Satan is.
It makes total sense. It makes total sense. That's exactly right. You don't hand somebody a pink $100 bill. You want to derive authority from somebody.
Right.
There's got to be some credibility. If I walked up to you and I just said, let me tell you something. My Savior died, and his blood dripping down that cross saved you, and you need to worship at the foot of that cross. You would, and you know, you didn't have all this. The
well, I say, wait a minute. Man kills your God. Why would I want? To follow a dead god. Oh, but your god was bodily resurrected, like all other pagan religious deities.
Like Hestus. Hestus seems
like
on the ground. Three
okay,
days.
and so I'm sure then when your god was resurrected bodily, that there's proof of this, like lots of testimony of people that recognized him, right? The only testimony says they didn't recognize him. Oh.
Well, not only that, but then you got to go into, when you go into the Mizmors and stuff, he says, and you did not give me over to death. Oh, well, okay. Well, that's a problem, because the Messiah that's being, you know, crucified here and all this says, you did not give me over to death. So if your God died.
So why does your God say, my God, why have you left me? Why have you forsaken me? Before the body died on that upright pole? If God died for your sins?
Exactly.
I tell you, I don't get it. Now, to drive the point home that I was making, in the Garden of Eden, when Satan arrived one morning, bright and beautiful, he seduced Chawa into believing him by removing something Yahweh said from its context, truncating the statement, and then twisting it to make it appear that his proposition was consistent with God's, that he had a better understanding of things than did God. He did not present himself as an alternative to God or as God's adversary, but instead as someone who could be believed because he quoted God. He did not offer a different life, a different place, a different way, but simply corrupted Yahweh's testimony to confuse his audience. It made Satan appear credible. It's exactly what Paul did, right down to the smallest nuance. The ploy that prevailed for Satan in a small way prevailed for Shaul in a big way. Very few things are as important as that recognition. And finally, the fifth insight, one which is directly related to the previous four, and in fact is derived to it. So let's go through the passage again and see if we can deduce what that is. For in and beside the window of my home, for my family, through the lattice denoting the proper order and timing of things, from a higher elevation I looked down and I saw, with her were the simple-minded, naive, those who were easily deceived, the malleable, who were readily persuaded, the ignorant and irrational with deficient judgment. I made the connection and understanding, recognizing, discerning, and deducing the relationship by noticing among the children there was a young man of deficient character, lacking judgment, bereaved in his ability to reason, senseless with a weak heart. Who do you think that might have been? Who was identified with the whore of religion?
That would be Sheol.
The whore of Babylon. Yeah.
Sheol. Yeah.
What man authored the world's most popular religion? What man claimed to have seen God when in fact he encountered Satan? What man claimed to speak for God while also admitting to have been demon-possessed? What man openly acknowledged that his character was deficient and then proved it through his writings that he lacked judgment? What man claimed as his exclusive audience those who were wholly and completely ignorant of the Torah? What man predicated his entire religious message on faith rather than reason, on belief rather than knowledge, to deceive the malleable? What man walked through the known world, amassing a group of followers along the way? Not surprising, the name of the man that answers each of these questions is one and the same. And his name is presented at the end of the proverb, Shaul. Now that should be pretty obvious too, don't you think? You look at each of the...
Not only that, I mean, he throws up he who is lowly and little, which is what Paulos means. So he names Sheol... three times, because you've got him named here, you've got him in Yashayah being named, and you've got him in Chabawak being named. I mean, literally, says Sheol. And then he says he was lowly and little.
Yes.
As well.
Well, the difference between what happened now and what people don't normally do is nobody looks these things up. So you have to know that Paulos means lowly and little, and you have to know he changed his name to a Roman name, and that he was Jewish, or he was Yehudim, and his name was Shaul, and then you have to look up what Shaul is, which is hard to do because it usually goes to Sheol. But, I mean, that's not a whole lot of work you'd have to do to get to that point. But the difference in what I hear from people now is that a lot of people want to look things up. So good for them. I mean,
you know, it's interesting too. It's not only Sheol and Sheol, but also don't all the rabbinics run to their shawl?
Mm-hmm. They all share the same base root word. I mean, it's just damned.
Yeah, Shaul, you know. Shaul, Sheol.
If y'all have had an impact, if anything, I don't think anything's greater than people actually starting to look things up. Because some of them even tell me, they say, look, I bought all these things. That's terrific.
Yes, well, no, I think that's terrific,
just to look
too.
It, up. It is terrific. And particularly if you're going to say, okay, I'm going to be as informed as I can be, which means you've got to look it all up, right? And then I'm going to be as rational as I can be, which means you're going to make every connection that reasonably fits. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
If you do those
right.
two things, every time you dive into the word, the lights just go off everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. I never thought when I read that book, you know, when you did send out the Chabot thing, and even the first one, not the last one, I never believed that it would be the plague of death, Paul, Chabot, everywhere.
Everywhere.
My gosh, it's everywhere.
I mean, it's everywhere. Like, well,
it's not just
jail,
it's also plague of death.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
2018.
That was
listed again. And Yasha Yah. Yeah, everywhere. Proverbs 7, Shaul.
And plague of death.
Describes him in Proverbs 6. I mean, there's a reason that God's fixated on this man. The reason that he has so much prophetic testimony on this man, on the whore that seduced him, on Satan, on Babylon, and Christianity, is because the religion that Paul conceived is a construct that is a counterfeit of Yahweh's covenant, set right outside of Yahweh's home, that has fooled thus far 5 billion people. You know,
yeah, like Easter taking the place of Passover.
5 billion people, you'll get God's attention.
Right, right. But it's like Easter taking over Passover. Boom. That's
right.
Just a straight up corruption right there. Boom.
Pure counterfeit. Right.
Yeah, just
and
straight up.
And it's so obvious that one is true and the other is a pagan Babylonian lie. How in the world could there be 1.2 billion Christians, or excuse me, 2.4 billion Christians today? 1.2
Because no matter
Christians.
What you present to them, I can tell you the answer, Craig, because no matter what you present to them, the irrational mind, as you put it, closes. And that's what
right.
happens. It's all emotion. It's got nothing
right.
to do with
religious mind.
You show them, look. I mean, you break it right down to, you know, the Lord's covenant. That was the vernal equinox on Sunday, nearest the vernal equinox, where Lord Baal was worshipped in the form of a golden calf with the sun between his horns. And incidentally, that's when you're going to find the sun in constellation with Taurus the bull.
Right.
That's Easter Sunday. Get it?
Right.
That was the
Lord's
day. And they say,
right.
How dare you heretic, you're going to burn in the worst places of hell. And,
right.
you know, in other words,
why
reality
do you think that Satan inspired the Babylonians to see in that stars a bull?
Yes.
Because it was perfect to create a counterfeit. Because Satan doesn't want to create a religion where Satan is considered to be God. Satan wants to create a religion where Satan is no longer Satan, but is instead God. So it's all designed to confuse and to pile the rubbish right on top of the truth.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm telling you, you can
flat out show these things to people. You can show them. You can date them. You can say, here's a quote. You can put it out there. And instead of taking any of it to heart or using a seat of judgment to think about as you talk about, being rational, no, it just doesn't exist. It doesn't matter. See, the first time I heard it, I said, the first time I heard the truth, and this is what I found with people that decide to get on the narrow path. They say, you know, they all say the same thing. The first time I heard the truth, wow, it was refreshing, and I knew it was the truth.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're going to close your ears, or, you know, let's say I was driving down the road that night, and I heard you on the radio, and you were talking about church steeples being the first and the last thing to kiss the sun, and this is all about sun worship, and you've been had too. And I said, and I got emotional. I says, oh, this guy, he's going to the worst places of hell, you know, and turned the radio off.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where these people are at.
That's where they're at. Yeah, you know, it's like being on that Radio Liberty with Stan Monteith, and I could assail Islam all day, and no problem with Soul Stan, but you prove that Pauline Christianity is a fraud, and oh man, you are not welcome back. I've got no answer for you, but you're not welcome back.
Right. Well, yeah. See, that is the problem, isn't it? And I would have been happy to have been in that room.
Stan was buying everything you were saying. And it was the feedback he got, and then he lost his meal ticket.
That's correct. He didn't have an argument against
anything. He was actually getting on board. I mean, you could almost see.
Yeah. It's just that. He was going to lose his audience if he.
If the truth was put out there on his show, he'd be in a lot of trouble. But see, that's part of the beauty of what we do, and what you do, because you spend countless hours. And I realize to you, it's not work; it's a lot of fun. I get that.
We work.
It doesn't matter. Most people sell it.
Fun work, yeah.
You know, there are people in the religion business. They go by names like Nehemiah Gordon or like Jeff Banner, who don't know Yahweh, but they sell books and they make money in these businesses.
Right.
Yeah, and they don't know Yahweh. They never will because they've never even seriously considered the words.
Well,
you know?
First of all, if you were to charge for it, then you could not do what we're doing now, which is to celebrate it on
the truth.
Yeah.
You also
number two, if you were selling it, your connection to Yahweh would be cut off. So at that point, some of the insights which, you know, I think we're led to, so long as we're spending our time with our eyes and minds open studying the Torah, the insights fall into our lap. They're so obvious. But if you're selling the information, God's not going to help.
No, of course he's not. But I mean, you know, this is what goes on. Or the vegan rabbi, the doctor that wrote the book that's in touch with the rabbi who has the real scriptures tucked away neatly in a vault. Thank you for sharing them, Rabbi. Yeah, we appreciate you. I'm sure God appreciates you, you know, getting his word out there by selling a book. You know, this is the kind of nonsense we're up against.
Right.
You know, when people tell me that they've got
four blood moons, right? I don't.
Yeah, or
did
that
Hagee
too.
Come up with an apology for the four blood moons? Has he offered everybody that bought the piece of trash their money back?
What did it turn out
as he had predicted? It was not the hand of God.
Oh, don't you know now it's the year 2016 that's the Yobel year.
Yeah, just moved everything.
Yeah, it's just on and on, these guys. They've got an excuse for everything. But, you know, as I sit down and I look at what's going on in the religious community, they're all falling apart because they're running out of shtick. They really are out of shtick.
Yeah, there's another tragedy here about Christianity, that the people who approached it that had logical minds, I wish I had been one earlier, had approached it with logical minds and saw that it was a bunch of garbage.
Right.
They got turned off and they just walked away completely. You know, I've met a lot of folks like that. They're the scientific
mind. Yeah. I was one of those.
Of
you know, I began to question Christianity. There were so many contradictions in Christianity that I began to question. I just walked away and I became an agnostic.
Mm-hmm. And some of them never found their way.
Right.
It's a shame they just stopped looking.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who read Prophet of Doom ceased to, I know I've gotten letters from many of them, they ceased to be Muslims. They realized the religion was stupid, and they walked away from it. Now, it's better to have walked away from religion than to have been trapped in religion, but it doesn't get you home.
No,
it doesn't. Yeah, you remember the woman last week I was talking about, you know, didn't like my use
of the term
that... Duck that rhymes with duck and starts with F.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
The thing about her, one of the things she said, and you use Craig Wynn's translations nearly all the time, And, you know, I wanted to correct her and say no all the time. You know, and I mean, there's a couple of times I've used Kirk's, I mean, once or twice. I mean, a couple of Terry's, but other than that, I use yours. And, you know, I thought, you know, lady, I'm laying out to you the best thought out translations in the world with proof, as in the word right there and what it could possibly mean, in context. And you're throwing up to me, Matthew 24:12, and not even saying anything. It's just throw it up. You know, I mean, do you have a translation
and
that I can even
you
look
You know what's
at?
Most amazing about the whole thing? There is no Matthew 24:12. You know, every one of these books. I mean, when you just I just hate it when people just throw out a number.
I know.
As if God gave verses and numbers. He didn't give verses and numbers.
I know he did.
John 3:16. Mike George.
Yeah, I had a guy use that on me today. He was calling. He says, "The Lord owns the world and all in it," and all this. And I said, "Well, I don't know about this Lord asshole." I did a post on a summation of the words of the Lord, which is, "Praise me, bow to me, worship me, and I'll burn you in a pit forever." You know, and that's the summation of the Lord's words. I mean, it really is. It's a beautiful summation of what we see.
Yeah,
wasn't
it interesting though in Revelation when the messenger is speaking to Yahochanan? And the messenger says that the rulers are all of those 10 kingdoms are all empowered by and owe their authority to and work on behalf of the whore, and yet they all hate the whore and are in opposition to the whore, which is to say that you just when you're in that club, don't trust anybody. They're all in it for themselves.
Yeah, well, which is to say you can't trust your boss. You hate your boss.
Correct.
I mean, yeah, and which is a really bad place to be in, you know. But you know, I look at this stuff today, and like I say, as I lay it out there, and I watch some of the things that are said, the reason that we have a secret group, you know, there's different settings you can use an FB. One is secret. One is, I guess, invited. The other's open or whatever it is. I keep it secret simply because we don't want – we're in there sharing words, concepts, and we're letting our hair down as well at the same time, having a good laugh.
Right.
And, you know, this is not a religious organization. I put that right on the thing. If you're involved in religion, you really don't need to be in here. You don't want to be in here.
You're not welcome.
Yeah, you're just not welcome. But, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, people come in anyway and start spewing out religion. The woman who hated the F-bomb, as an example, came in and started throwing out a bunch of New Testament stuff and how we're to love everybody. And I said, well, this is garbage. This is anti-Torah. It's not anything we're going to accept in here. You need to go down the street and sell the God is love story to somebody else because it just isn't true. And if you've bought into those lies, you know, you need to rethink your position because your position is just, it's the antithesis of the truth.
Yeah.
Then we had a guy
like, for example, it's alleged that, you know, God said, judge not lest you be judged.
Right.
That's the antithesis.
You can't make a decision
about
anything.
And when it says,
he's telling us to judge all things against the Torah.
Once again, it's the antithesis of what the Torah says.
I know. We're to believe that Yahusha said, hey, forget the Torah? He sounds more like Paul.
What did Yahusha say to those who were opposed to him? That you're scumbags.
Yeah.
That's
didn't love
them.
Hated them. What does Yahweh say to the religious and the powerful? Not only do I hate them, I'm going to judge you and punish you.
We had another guy come in. And I'm not even going to give his name, but he was a total joke. He came in and started with the F thing, and I don't like the and you need to clean it up in here. And, you know, there isn't a lot of this in there. I mean, it was just something I said. You know, it's not like anybody's in there just talking like that constantly. And then he was giving advice. He said, first of all, that he was the mouthpiece of Yahuwah. And they all have the U in there for some reason.
He was a mouthpiece. He personally.
Yeah, he's a mouthpiece. He said he was God's mouthpiece. He said it.
And then he was giving advice to a guy, get this, who had spilled breakfast cereal on his sofa, and that for matzah, he needed to get rid of it. So he actually thinks that matzah is about getting rid of sofas that had some leavening breakfast cereal in it. I said, buddy, you sound like a rabbi on steroids. I said, why don't you just have one come in and bless your home while you're at it?
Well,
are you?
You know,
nuts?
There's some people that can claim to be the mouthpiece of Yahweh. Moshe, the buddy, he's the mouthpiece of Yahweh. Absolutely comfortable with calling Moshe the mouthpiece of Yahweh. Yosha, mouthpiece of Yahweh. And for a specific period of time, for a specific message, so were fellows like Yashaya and Yirmiyah.
And Dode.
Yep.
And
Dode,
But the list of those who can claim to be the mouthpiece of Yahweh is really
small.
And oh, by the way, not one of them claims to be the mouthpiece of Yahweh.
No, I say he told me to tell you this.
Well, I mean, it was astounding to me, this guy. And, you know, the one thing that they all do is they come in and they start teaching. Now, can you imagine teaching to a group that has access to these radio shows and this information for years and actually read it and study it? Can you imagine coming in and calling yourself a mouthpiece for God? Do you know how far you're going to go in a group like that?
Ooh, wow, no.
You're going to go as far as about we would go if we walked in the Vatican and started telling the truth. You're just going to get
anywhere. It's just not going to fly.
We can't chop your head off, but, you know, we can certainly boot you in a big hurry.
Yeah.
And this
I would
is what
love
happens.
To be, and I think we'd all would love to be the mouthpiece of Yahweh. That would be a great, wonderful, empowering honor. What a thrill that would be.
Well, no,
it's a big thrill just being able to share what Yahweh shared. But, you know, sharing what Yahweh shared through the people that he spoke through is a far cry from being the mouthpiece of Yahweh.
But I think we will be mouthpieces because he talks about us being his uniters, spokespeople. I'm talking about the next dimension. I'm talking about the next dimension.
Yeah, I think to some degree. I mean, I don't think I'd ever want the burden or the responsibility of being the mouthpiece of Yahweh. I'm happy to.
No, not a constant, but, you know, to go send a message to somebody, I think it would be great.
If God gives us a job and says, I want you to convey this message to somebody, I'm happy to do it, but I'm going to do it under the auspices that I'm his kid.
Yeah. Well, I would just follow the instruction. You know?
Idea that God has a higher view of me than I have of myself, and I think if we keep it that way, that he's excited when we figure something out, and he thinks that our capability is beyond what we typically view it as. But as
we're pretty limited.
We are, but we can still. I mean, we had fun tonight figuring this stuff out.
It's beautiful, and the prophecy is beautiful. I mean, just as a point of prophecy, just like I thought with Chabawalk. You know, how is it you can show that to somebody, and it's a total description. You know, you go through chapter 1 and 2 of Chabawalk, okay? And you show them, you know, wow, look at how perfect this prophecy is. It's just astounding. And then somebody goes to you, John 3:16. Or something like that, or they misquote. They often want to misquote the Shimon. I think
and John 3:15. Have you ever read John 3:1-15?
Yes.
Because if you read 1-15, you know that the answer is in the Torah.
Right. Well, I've got a whole note that I've done, and I don't even use Yahochanan. I use Yahweh's words, and I use Yahusha's words, and I show them, you know, straight up that he was the living embodiment of the Torah, or he couldn't have been the Masiyah. Right. He couldn't have been the brilliant servant, because that's who he had to actually be, the mouthpiece of the Torah. So you can't just go, John 3:16... or What? Which one is it with Shimon that they're out there?
Yeah, for example, it's even that one is whoever trusts and relies on me. Now, how can you trust and rely on him if you don't know who he is? How can you trust and rely him and not be Torah observant?
Well, I think he makes that real clear. You can't, and how can you say that you believe in me and not do what I do?
You're right.
You know, I mean, yeah, I mean,
he was Torah observant.
It's Shimon 3:15. That's what Second Shimon 3:15 and 16 that they're forever trying to hold up when
right.
where Shimon calls him a sophist. A sophist.
Yeah.
Would
and
you
wish
anybody
his,
who represented Yahweh calling you
from,
a sophist?
From man will lead to death and destruction.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
But they'll take the one line out of context to say
context.
That, well, you know, Peter said that Paul wrote Scripture. No, he didn't.
He said the opposite.
He said it's the opposite.
Destructive, damning, it'll kill
right.
you. Don't
right.
read it.
Circular reasoning of man. It's part of the sophist. Yeah, it was. Sophist is Greek philosophy. Gnosticism.
Yeah, well, and it's also people that come from a faulty premise to advance themselves for the gain of money, which is what Paulus did all the time. He wanted,
right.
pay me,
right.
pay me.
I deserve it. I deserve
yeah,
it.
I deserve
it.
I don't have a post, but I deserve it.
Yeah. You know, it's tough work taking people to Satan, which is what he said he did regularly.
Yeah, he turned them on over to Satan. And Satan helps him all the time.
I have never met Satan. I wouldn't know where to find Satan. I'm not interested in meeting Satan. I never want to meet Satan. I never want to have a conversation with Satan. I will guarantee you that never in my life am I going to take anyone to Satan. It is, but Paul said it twice.
Well, I think the reason Paul said it twice is because I think he knew Satan. In fact, I'm sure of it.
Of course.
I think it was Satan that talked to him on the road to Damascus. That's what I think.
Yeah, of course. It's obvious.
You know him well.
Yeah, yeah. He was in a position to take people to Satan. And
well, you know, as you put this stuff out there, you know, they no longer have to listen to what Paulo says. That's another thing. One of the great things they do is they run to Paul to prove Paul. You know, as you said, the book of Acts, the book by Paul, all about Paul. You know, and of course, once you know that Luke is just Paul's historian and he's just writing down what Paulo's told him to write.
Although, you know, when you really read Luke,
Luke turned Paulos over. He said he didn't know God.
Yeah, Luke
came
up on
people
him.
That didn't
Luke came up on him.
Yeah, right. So
you know, I'm going to tell you what the man said, and this is what happened. But you know, you ought to figure it out. It ain't real. And Luke left him. In the end, Luke abandoned him.
Yeah, no, I know. We went over that. Remember we did this show maybe 4 or 5 years ago where when you know, we were still looking at the Greek text a lot and stuff like that.
Right.
And of course now I just don't even see much need other than to show that how confusing it is and how it's in total opposition, you know. I mean, because that's what it is. It's just garbage.
I mean, I think there's every reason to conclude that Galatians was written well before Acts, and that since the Acts account of the Jerusalem summit is the antithesis of Paul's account in Galatians, and Luke absolutely would have had a copy of Paul's letter to the Galatians, and yet wrote a presentation of what happened at the council that's wholly and completely contradictory to Paul's explanation. It says he never did buy it.
No. Well, guys, I'm going to have to sneak out because I got to
work. Okay, yeah.
But I will talk to you tomorrow, of course. And happy Shabbat or Shabbat Shalom to both of you. And I'll talk to you
next
time. Okay, right.
I'm in the midst of matzah at this point. I'm enjoying it, and I'm going to enjoy Bikurim tomorrow.
I'm going to tell you my, which is really interesting about timing, and I'm just sharing my personal feelings here. But the most enjoyable Passover I ever celebrated was this Passover, and I did it at the wrong time. And it was close to the right time in the sense of you had either this full moon or the full moon preceding it. And I was really close to the right time, but, you know, I was with my son, and we had the opportunity to celebrate it early. God was as much a part of that celebration as any I've ever had, and reemphasized to me that just as he was willing to let Hezekiah celebrate it 2 weeks late, he was certainly willing to let us celebrate it a few days early.
No, the next thing you know, we'll be getting an attack on that. I'll be getting attacked for that, just like eating a BLT. It just gets gets tired. And by the way, One of the things, and I just want to point this out, you know, all the work that's been done in terms of and currently going with from everything from yada yada all the way up to observations here is astounding work. It's wonderful work. It's work that's really shared. I understand now why the mitzvah is as important as the mishpat. Okay, I get it. Because that's where you really learn about Yahweh's nature, isn't it? In his mitzvah.
Yeah.
I mean, if you really seriously look. And you also, you get all these guarantees because of prophecy. I mean, they're laid right out in front of you. And you sit there and you look at his mitzvah. And these things wouldn't have come about if somebody hadn't taken the time to do all the work and get Yada Yah published and throw it out there for us. And the last thing I ever want to hear from anybody is what a stupid windbot I am and how Craig is my leader. Craig isn't anyone's leader. Doesn't want to be anybody's leader.
No.
And excuse me if I use the most accurate translations on the planet. And until you can present something that's more accurate, just shut up about it.
Yeah.
You know,
and by the way,
don't
attack I'm positive people. That somebody can create a more accurate, more complete
Great.
Translation.
Let them do it.
And Ben, I would encourage them to do it. I think it's a good thing. I would encourage them to do it. I gladly acquiesce to them if they can create a. I'm positive that somebody can, and if somebody does, so much the better. It's not a competition.
Yeah, but don't sit there. Do not sit there and attack somebody who's done a lot of free work. I mean, that's what it sounds like. It almost sounds like
you're charging
for this or something.
And if you don't have a better, more accurate rendering of these passages, then don't criticize them. Criticize them if you've got something that's more accurate. But if you don't, don't.
Yeah, right. Don't throw up to me
right.
John 3:16 and walk away. You better have the translation.
What Kirk does. You know, Kirk looks at the translations on his own prior to looking at mine and after looking at mine and saying, you know, I can add to them. I can augment them. I can deduce additional insights on my own. But, you know, he's not saying that... that I need to throw them away because they're inaccurate. And, in fact, the more research he does, the more comfortable he is with them.
Let me ask you something. Can I ask you something, Craig?
Yeah.
How much money have you made producing Yada Yah all the way up through observations and the radio shows?
Probably lost $100,000.
$100,000? What, no followers?
Negative.
Nobody's mailing
not made,
you a check or anything?
Not invested in it.
No, I understand. I understand.
Between resources I've purchased and programming and web fees and publishing costs and everything else, probably invested $100,000 in it.
And you don't charge for any of this, do you?
No.
Yeah. Okay.
No.
Well. I just wanted to get that out there because I'm frankly tired of hearing.
No, but I couldn't. I mean, I can't. I wouldn't.
Of course you can.
I'm going to tell you that it was a tremendous benefit to have earned some success in business and to be able to retire so that I can invest my time in this without remuneration. So I'm not sacrificing anything not to be remunerated, but when I read Yahweh's testimony, I am quite confident that God does not appreciate it when people try to profit from what he financially from his testimony.
I'm real comfortable with that statement. I think they're over with at that point when they're running around trying to make money off of
this. And really the best we can hope for with Yahweh is that as we study, that he, through the set-apart spirit and through the words themselves, helps us make the connections that lead to understanding. That's really what we're asking him to do in all of this. And I think he does it with those who do it freely out of the joy of discovery. And I don't think he does it on behalf of those who do it for a living.
I don't believe that anybody that's out there, advancing themselves for money and using Yahweh's reputation to do it is covenant. I think that they're in danger of a lot worse.
I don't think anyone who is covenant is charging for it. And I can tell you that being covenant and not charging for it, I'm infinitely richer than anyone who is not covenant who has charged.
I just want to get it clear. I want to make it clear that you know, this is not a paid radio show. This is something that you shell out for every month.
No, in fact, I pay $500 a year. I think it's maybe even $600. In fact, I think it went up to $1,000 a year. I pay $1,000 a year for the opportunity to use Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, there you go. And there's no money coming in. There's no commercials.
No.
Nobody sends you money. I've never seen a donate button on any of the web pages.
No.
There will never be one.
That's all.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to make that perfectly clear to anybody listening.
It's important to underscore the point that we're not here to profit monetarily. We are enriched.
Yes.
That's exactly right.
Yeah,
we are enriched beyond comprehension. It's just that not with something as useless as money.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you. I just want to get that out there. I think every now and then that has to put out there. And you did see some small success in business, like to the tune of $3 billion company at one time, which is unbelievably wildly successful in most people's eyes.
It did is a number of things that were essential to being in this position. One is I was so publicly crucified, wrongly so, in the press, that I lost any concern for being criticized.
And didn't they have to write a retraction for that, by the way?
No, they never did write a retraction. I when I went through, and I wrote in the Business Week article, I found 77 statements of factual error. And I sent them to them, and I ended up writing a presentation I posted online for a number of years on the 77 errors in the article. But when I contacted an attorney to sue them, as a public figure, and I was a public figure as it related to the story in the Business Week article, as a public figure, even though they not only made 77 statements of factual errors, and there was no way that they could not have known that what they were saying was untrue, that as a public figure, you have no rights. No.
Why do you think
no public
they did
figure
that?
Will ever
you
win
think
a,
that that was
a slander suit against
you
a
think it's because you were giving them too
paper.
Much competition? Was there one of these... were they in bed with one of your competitors? I mean, is that what? That's what I think. I mean, there's just no other reason.
Oh, the guy that wrote the article for Business Week. No, he was the guy that actually wrote the Jack Welch book called Winning. And I met Jack Welch. I was not impressed, but the president or CEO of GE. But the guy that wrote it was a real snake. I mean, he was a real snake. You know, I made him sign a statement that said that since I was the leading shareholder of the company and had just resigned from its board of directors, that we would only talk about the a very finite set of things, and that he would not write anything apart from this very finite things which legally we could discuss, and we would not go beyond that. And he signed it and then breached every aspect of it.
And that is just a
complete dishonest scumbag. It's just the nature of the media. But anyway, you know, it's, if it had not been for that experience, two things would not have been true. One is that by being in that experience, I was publicly humiliated. That is a prerequisite for doing this job. I could not have taken on Islam or Christianity or convey Yahweh's testimony in a public if I was not immune to criticism. You have to be. And that experience made me immune to criticism. I don't care anymore. I never read what anybody says about me. I don't care. And it provided the financial means to devote the time and energy to this. So I'm delighted it occurred. But, you know, also during that process, you know, I was exposed to a lot of things that you would normally not be exposed to. I mean, I was able to go meet with Al-Qaeda. Most people wouldn't have the means to do that. I was able to get to know America's leading politicians. Most people wouldn't have the means to do that. I had the opportunity to get to know very well America's foremost religious cleric. Most people wouldn't have the means to do that. And so those insights were essential to ultimately understanding. I mean, there's a reason that Moshe was the best pick to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt. He knew Egypt. You know, the reason that Hosea was asked to marry the Gomer, the temple prostitute, so he would understand what God was opposed to. And also, having been in that environment and been exposed to it was an essential aspect of doing this job. And just as was being an evangelist and a ruling elder in the Presbyterian Church. While I'm disgusted that I was those things, had I not been there, I don't think I would have ever had the insights necessary to convey this message. So, you know, it all works. It's all, you know, God's not in a hurry. You know, there's a lot of foundation that needs to be laid before we're in a position where we can be useful. All right, Larry. I wish you a good night, and may everyone have a wonderful Pesach and a happy Shabbat. Good night, everyone.